Welcome to Talking Bach, a podcast by Bach Academy Australia, hosted by me, Madeline Easton. In today's episode, my very special guest is the Australian pianist, Philip Schoffk. And for a lot of people, he needs no introduction at all. But I would like to just take the opportunity to read his biography on the University of Sydney's page, just to give you a little bit of an idea of who this man is and what he has achieved in his life. So Philip is considered to be one of Australia's foremost concert pianists, chamber musicians, accompanists, and pedagogues. After initial lessons with Anatole Mirojnik, he can correct my pronunciation of that later, he continued his studies with George Humphrey at the Sydney Conservatorium High School, from where he graduated with the Frank Hutchins Prize for being the most promising performer of his year. He then furthered his studies at the Moscow State Conservatory, studying with Professor Valery Kastelsky, himself a student of the legendary Heinrich Neuhaus, and graduating as a Master of Fine Arts with the highest marks in all musical subjects. In 1987, he became a laureate at the Vianney di Motta competition in Lisbon, and in 1988 at the Sydney International Competition, where he was awarded the Hepzibah Menuhin Prize and the Best Australian Pianist Prize. He was awarded a Best Accompanist Prize at the Tchaikovsky Competition in 1994. So there you have it. Philip, it's absolutely amazing that you are joining us here today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Look, I've known you a very, very, very long time.
Too long.
And you're a family friend, and you've been a student of my father at the Conservatorium of Music, which is absolutely amazing for me to actually have you on this podcast now, all these years later. Do you have any memories of that time as a student of my father at the Conservatorium?
He always had a wry grin.
Yes.
And I remember he had a beard at that stage.
A beard? Wow, I never knew about that.
Pretty sure he had a beard, yes. We were very lucky. We had people like him. We had people like Richard Gill. We had Robert Pickler. We had John Painter. We had Lois Simpson, you know, just this whole wonderful array of fabulous teachers who were inspiring. So your dad was one of a team, I would have said. And then, you know, when I had the great pleasure of teaching you, and I think you did you not play G major French suite, a little bit thereof? Yes, you did. See, what a memory.
I certainly did, yeah.
Of course, we should explain to your listeners that at that stage at the Con High, you had to have two instruments, and usually string players would choose or would be forced to choose the piano. But you were a very good pianist. I remember your memory was just sensational. You still remember a fugue that you played. Remember that Italian composer?
Yeah.
I can never remember his name. Carbonaro or something, no?
No.
Was he the pasta maker?
Cabanossi, I don't know.
He was the sausage.
I don't know. I loved playing the piano. Like, for me, it was relaxation because it wasn't my main instrument. And I just used to adore being able to come home and shut the door and just play the piano. Honestly, that was my escape from the world. And weirdly, it still is, you know.
Well, if it was good enough for Casals, then, you know.
It was wonderful to have you as my piano teacher. How lucky was I?
Well, amazingly, I didn't turn you off music and you still, I believe, have a love for it. So there you go.
That's right. Yeah, you didn't completely beat it out of me.
Didn't completely destroy it. No.
Oh. But for our listeners, what you might not know about Philip is that he's a bit of a chess champion with an international ranking. And I actually have memories of you and Tony Baldwin playing chess at lunchtimes when I was at the Conservatorium High School. And I used to think, wow, look at these two blokes playing chess like that. What got you into chess?
Oh, look, chess, I've always had a love for it. I think it's hard to say. I remember reading a book by about the Spassky Fish in 1972, by a world championship match by an American journalist and writer called George Steiner, and who mentioned a very interesting idea. Not that I was ever one like this, but he mentioned that there are three fields in which you can have child prodigies: chess, music, and mathematics. So there must be a strong connection between the three. And, you know, there have been many, well, history has proven there have been many people, like Prokofiev, for example, is a very, very good chess player. the ex-world champion chess player from the Soviet Union during Botvinnik's time, Valery Smyslov, was a very, very fine singer, very good tenor voice. And of course, there was Mark Taimanov, who was a professional pianist, who had a duet with his then wife, Lubov Brook. And of course, he was famous for playing Bobby Fischer in one of those matches before Fischer became world champion. So there's a strong connection. And of course, there was Philidor, François Philidor, who he was born in 1720, French, and then lived a long period of his life in England, wrote operas, very, very good composer, and also wrote chess treatises, and one of the strongest chess players of his time. So
that's amazing.
It is quite amazing, yes, yes.
Yeah. Did you ever compete in chess?
Oh, I played tournaments. Look, you know, the time you need to spend, I mean, I don't think I was, if you look at the average chess player, I mean, probably the really good ones look vaguely normal, I guess, but it requires a certain type of almost autism, you know, because you have to, I mean, look at Bobby Fischer, he just went crazy, you know, he had his fillings removed because he thought that, you know, the Soviets were listening in on all of his conversations through his metal, I mean, you know, just nuts. I mean, to go that far, it's a type of, what shall I say, insanity. George Steiner also mentions that there are more possible games of chess than there are atoms in the universe, which is quite an amazing thing. But it actually works mathematically. If you start to think of how many possibilities are on the first move, then on Black's first move, then on White's second move, and so on and so forth, it's completely endless.
Is that actually true?
It is actually true. It actually can be proven mathematically.
Oh, my Lord. That is amazing. I did not know that. I had this vague memory of someone saying to me, there are more possible chess moves than there are grains of rice in the world.
Well, you remember that was the old parable, wasn't it? How they figure out grains of rice and they start multiplying two by two, you know, two squared, two to the third, two to the fourth, two to the fifth, and then eventually it becomes huge, too big for whoever had to give that person the rice.
Mm. I really admire people who can think that way, especially the mathematical sort of aspect of it. I really struggled with that way of thinking, and I always have. And I would love to get into chess because it's such an amazing thing to do. But every time I sit down at the chessboard, my head starts to hurt, and I just want to run away. I just want to run away.
You have to be able to think ahead, and you have to be able to create what they call a tree of variations. In other words, if this, and then this, and that. If this, and you create what are called candidate moves for yourself, you know. And the other thing is, if you're playing competitive chess, you're actually limited in time. You might only have 20 minutes to do all of that.
Yeah, wow.
And so, you know, whilst a lot of it is being able to see ahead, and whoever can see the furthest ahead usually wins, the famous Cuban grandmaster and world champion, José Raúl Capablanca, who was actually a friend of Prokofiev's, in the States, where Prokofiev was living there in Chicago, producing his Love for Three Oranges, you know, he was asked, how many moves ahead do you think? And he said, only one move, but it is always the best move.
Yeah, I actually did some reading up on all of these people you're talking about. The amazing musical and chess connections throughout history, actually.
Yes.
And chess right now, it's really having a renaissance, isn't it? It's right
back
in the public consciousness.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been, how do you get, you know, chess involved in, you know, business, of course, with computers and things like that. But it's been I guess it's, to a certain extent, it's seen as glamorous, I guess. What does help is the fact that you've got the most populous countries in the world, China and India, being very, very good at chess. I mean, the current world chess champion is an Indian, and his challenger in the next round of world championship, well, the next world championship match will actually be a young Indian chap, Gukesh, and the women's world champion is a Chinese lady. So it always had that stigma in you know, Cold War times. The champions were from the Soviet Union, and you know, Bobby Fischer even learned Russian. He learned the language to be able to read Soviet chess magazines. Yeah, he could actually speak and read Russian. Yeah, he was so keen.
Yeah, but, you know, we have these television programs like The Queen's Gambit, which...
Yes, well, that was actually helped. Gary Kasparov, I think, was a collaborator on that, so he helped with ideas and things like that, which is one of the reasons why it was so exact, chess terms, yeah.
What did you think of that television series?
Look, I actually haven't seen The Queen's Gambit, but I have in my room at the Conservatorium, some photos of people playing chess, you know, various famous composers. I also have one of Bela Lugosi playing against Boris Karloff. Now, for your younger listeners and viewers, Boris Karloff was actually an Englishman. I forget his real name, John Smith or something, and he played these baddies in horror movies. And Bela Lugosi was Hungarian, and he was the first Dracula.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. I must show that picture.
Yeah, I'd be very keen to see that. Well, I can personally say I highly enjoyed that, and I think it's worth a watch. It's an amazing television series, and I had to watch it all again when I finished it.
I will, but I've because you know, once I get through the complete Lewis and the complete Morse and the complete deal and Pascal, and you know, it's
I know,
never
I know, yeah, I know, I know. But chess is sort of also in the public eye at the moment because everyone loves a scandal, right? And, you know, there's this huge public feud going on at the moment, you know, between who are these guys? These chess grandmasters, Magnus Carlsen and Hans Niemann. Literally made international news.
I don't know all the ins and outs of that, but it would seem that Niemann, I mean, nowadays, of course, if you have a mobile, so you're not allowed to take your phone into a chess tournament. If your phone sounds in a chess tournament, if it rings, you're disqualified immediately.
Yeah.
So it's got to be off. But then, you know, people do toilet breaks or something, and you know, there's suspicion that there might be a phone there somewhere, or there's some sort of communication device in somebody's shoe and things like that. So it's almost get smart standard. You know,
it's very James Bond, isn't it?
It's very James Bond.
Yes. Well, yeah, get smart.
Missed it by that much, yeah. Good thinking, 99. That's right.
Oh, but you've already talked about how amazing a chess player Prokofiev was in terms of classical music.
He was.
But I found when I was researching this this wonderful interview with Garry Kasparov from the New York Times, being interviewed about two composers, actually, Beethoven and Bach. And he was given two pieces to listen to. The first was the Eroica Symphony of Beethoven. And the second one was the Goldberg Variations of Bach. And it was the Bach that he could relate to as a chess player most. Mm-hmm. And this was what he said after having listened to the Goldberg Variations. He said, "The Goldbergs are not just one piece. It's like an encyclopedia of music. It was quite a discovery to understand that Bach introduced many future themes," which makes me think that he was thinking ahead. "From the chess or computer world, I would use the term founding father. I am amazed by people who are ahead of their time. I see the aria as someone godly or something godly, heavenly. But then it goes back to earth. It's this combination, the variety. And in the first 10 variations, Bach is basically demonstrating his power as a composer. But then he shifts to something that is much more interesting. In many of the variations, we can hear the herald of new music. I have one favourite, Variation 25. It's Chopin. It's the first ballade. And I love Chopin. It may sound sad, but it's not sadness. It's a kind of realism. The world as it is, and we have to accept it. It makes me feel comfortable. I also like Variation 13. It draws you into this water of music. And for energy and style, I would pick number 16. In Variations 14 and 29, Bach is a virtuoso a la Liszt. Thank you for forcing me to listen to the Goldberg Variations. Now I have a greater appreciation of Bach. I was very surprised how modern it feels." So that is a chess champion's first hearing and reaction to the Goldberg Variations. And I find it fascinating that he picked up instantly the fact that Bach was looking ahead in terms of, because they're variations, aren't they? And so he had this one aria. And like any good chess player, he would be searching for ways he could develop the theme and make it better. I think that's absolutely remarkable.
It is remarkable, and it's incredible. You say he was looking ahead, and yet for many people after he died, he was considered old-fashioned.
It's crazy, isn't it?
And Handel was considered a much better composer, you know, and we know how Schumann, you know, of course, Schumann, Mendelssohn and Chopin helped to, you know, gave money to arrange the first performance of St. Matthew Passion after his demise and all that. Remarkable. It's
absolutely. And I'd just like to play a few of these Goldberg variations for our listeners so you too can hear them. ¶¶ So that was the opening aria from Bach's Goldberg Variations, BWV 988, aria played by the one and only Richard Egar. Aren't they absolutely beautiful, Philip?
Well, if it's one of the most beautiful works of art ever created, and I speak very ironically with tongue in cheek, is a complete failure. Because do we go to sleep? No, we don't. And that's what it was designed for. Wasn't it supposed to put the Swedish ambassador to sleep? Didn't he have insomnia?
I don't know.
Yes.
What?
That's as far as I know.
Oh, my gosh. I'm looking into that right now.
Yes. Look into that. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And if anyone out there knows about this, please do write to me via the website and let me know.
Before you go on, I'm also intrigued by, I don't know, do you know about the NASA Golden Record?
Yes, I do. 1977. Okay.
On the Voyager first spacecraft. Okay?
It certainly is.
And guess which Bach pieces are on that?
I know exactly which ones. It's the Preludio. Oh, no, it's the Gavotton Rondo from the Bach E major Partita. And it's Brandenburg Concerto number 2, the F major.
Yes.
And some of the Goldberg versions. That's it. There were 3 pieces on that record.
It's actually not the Goldberg. It's the. I think you're going to play later the C major, the Prelude from Book 1.
Oh, is that what it is?
It's the C major Prelude from Book 2.
Ah!
Played by Glenn Gould.
Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing.
And these were chosen by Carl Sagan, you know, who does those terrific science programs. So,
yeah.
And there's also some of your stuff, if I may put it that way. It's the Gavotton Rondo, and it's played by Artur Grumio.
That's right. And were there not 27 pieces of music altogether?
Oh, there's lots of stuff. There are all these songs. There's pieces from Senegal and Zaire, and there's an Aboriginal song, Morning Star, Devil Bird, and there's Mexico. And there's Johnny B. Goode, Chuck Berry, of course.
Yeah.
And he was criticized for putting Johnny B. Goode on it, Carl Sagan. Somebody said, oh, that's music for adolescents. And you know what he said? Well, there are lots of adolescents out there in outer space.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
But what's amazing is that Bach takes up the largest percentage of any single composer on that record.
Yeah. I mean, Bach is just elemental, isn't it? I mean, you can do anything. You can play him on kazoo, you can jazz him up, rock him up, you can sing him. And
it's indestructibly good music.
It's indestructible, isn't it? And it just enhances the beauty somehow. Yeah.
I know. Bachable. It's incredible.
So you're lucky to be involved in playing Bach.
Look, it's my honour. It is. And you know who got me into Bach in the first place? It was my father.
Wonderful.
He used to play it all the time at home. You know, one day I asked
him. What did he actually play? Oh, you mean like at the piano?
Yeah, sometimes. But he would put on music, CDs, and the occasional LP. And, yeah, he said his favourite piece was the B minor mass out of all of them. Yeah. He didn't play the cantatas because I'm not really sure he knew many of them, actually. No. But he did play that B minor mass over and over and over and over and over
again. Well, there are so many cantatas, aren't there? I mean,
it's
a lifetime enough to hear them all. I mean.
But he, being a composer, was very heavily influenced by him. And he wrote that piece. It's dedicated to you. It's called Metamorphosen. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember it. I have it. Yes.
That was solely and only influenced by my father's love of Bach.
Look, you can't be a good composer and not be influenced by Bach, I don't think. The whole idea of texture, you know, the whole idea of how parts work, counterpoint, polyphony. You know, we hear the famous story about Chopin on the Isle of Mallorca when it rained and he was composing the Rage of the Prelude and carrying around, you know, these heavy tomes of the 48 preludes and fugues under his armpit all the time. So, yeah. And very often when I'm teaching, I actually point out something to a student, and it could be a piece of Chopin or Schumann or Liszt or Debussy or Rachmaninoff, and I say, look at this. Imagine that it's a Bach two-part invention. Play it like a Bach two-part invention, and suddenly it sounds wonderful. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah.
The famous Soviet pianist Lev Lysenko, who lived for a short period of his life, towards the end of his life in Brisbane, he was asked the question, Lev Nikolaevich, how should we play Bach, you know, with the implication that do ornaments, you know, do we begin the trills on the beat, before the beat, after the beat? Is there a Vorschlag? Is there a Nachschlag? Are they proud trillers? Whatever they are, you know. And you know what his answer was? How do we play Bach? We should play Bach very well.
Yeah. Well, I know. You can, and I want to talk about that more a bit later on, actually.
Okay. You
know, because it can be incredibly intellectual, but at the end of the day, it is a spiritual and emotional experience.
Absolutely. Feeling.
Yeah, that's right. So when did you discover Bach? Was it through those 48 Preludes and Fugues?
Look, I probably think it must have been hearing the C major from book one and just being struck by the, well, I mean, you know, you don't have to be religious, but there is something ethereal and spiritual about heavenly about it, isn't there?
Yeah.
The way nothing happens, but everything happens at the same time. So
that's a very, very good way of describing it.
You know, it's just a couple of chords. Oh, yeah, I'll just, you know, I'll spread them out like this. I'll go through a few diminished chords and I'll have this one here. They'll have a suspended fourth or something here. And we'll eventually, after a little journey, and you know, end back in C major. And just what a journey.
I mean, you know. I know. I never, ever get tired of listening to that piece.
No, you can't. You can't. You can't get tired of that. You can't get tired of, I don't know, the brand. I mean, that the rhythm, those violas, you know, say what you like about the viola, but the two violas.
I know.
That amazing rollicking rhythm that he sets up is just mind-boggling. It just amazes me every time I hear it.
Absolutely. And just so everybody knows the piece we're talking about just then, I'd like to play you the prelude, the C major prelude from book one of The Well-Tempered Clavier. So you just heard Bach's Das Wohltemperierte Klavier, Book 1, the C major prelude, played by the world-famous harpsichord player Ton Koopman. So this program we've got coming up is called Bach, the Mind of a Genius. And what I'm interested in here is how such a mind operates. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Look, interestingly enough, Heinrich Neuhaus, in his book, The Art of Piano Playing, talks about Bach, the teacher, because, as you know, Bach taught a lot of his children, and some of them turned out to be pretty mighty fine composers themselves and musical personalities. And so these were the days before anybody wrote etudes or studies, you know, to help with certain things of technique. But if you take, well, the D minor prelude, there are certain perpetual motion preludes of Bach, the D minor, the G major, the D major from book two, and you actually use them as etudes, your technique as a piano player, as a keyboard player, just improves enormously. Not only that, if you think about paired fingering that the French composers used to use and the way they used to play scales, you know, third and fourth, third and fourth, third and fourth, and so it would seem that Bach was one of the first sort of people to suddenly look at the structure of the hand and think, well, hang on, why aren't we using our thumb? You know, I believe it was considered bad manners to, you know, use your thumb when you ate, of course, you know. I don't know why you held a fork or a knife or something. There's some connection with all of that. And
oh, gosh, okay.
Class. And so Bach said, well, hang on, the hand needs the thumb. The hand, yeah, we need. And so, and when you play a keyboard instrument, particularly the piano, I mean, the thumb is such an integral part. If you know where your thumb is, you know where the rest of your hand is. So you know if you're playing something that's difficult, positionally speaking, you know, you feel much more secure. So. And as far as I can see, Bach was one of the first people to understand this and use it in his music.
Absolutely. I think my definition of what a genius mind does or how they think is they have an amazing ability to take something we see every day, you know, whether it be the hand or the same 12 notes of the chromatic scale that everybody's always had, and take them and create something utterly new and groundbreaking and modern and influential and incredibly meaningful with the same thing we see every day. And, you know, I mean, look what von Gogh did with the haystack. He took an everyday haystack and changed the way we thought about art in one painting. And look what Monet did with a bunch of water lilies. You know, that was absolutely groundbreaking. Look what Picasso did with a face. These people take the everyday and make it new and make us see it in a very different way. Or a playwright writing a play. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are the people that we consider geniuses. And I think this is what Bach did for music. He took the same 12 notes and utterly revolutionized music for the rest of time.
And there must have been such a humility in Bach also.
Because, oh, yeah. I mean,
you know, he... Buxtehude was considered the greatest organist of his time, wasn't he? And so, but how did Bach listen to Buxtehude? He couldn't, you know, switch on a computer or a television or a CD player or, you know, YouTube or Spotify. He walked how 300 kilometers?
400.
400. There you
280
go. miles. 280 miles to hear Lübeck play the organ. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know.
This is what our next concert series is all about. It's called The Road to Lübeck in the Steps of Bach.
Oh, okay.
We're designing it all around that trip, and we're performing in venues with really great organs. So just bear that in mind, everybody.
Wonderful.
We're really going to get into that journey he took on his own.
Yeah.
The music he took with him and what came of that, what resulted in it.
To hear a colleague, to hear a peer, you know.
Yeah. But I believe Bach had a mind a bit like a chess champion in that he could see so many moves ahead harmonically and thematically. Like, for example, he would pick a fugue subject that he knew he'd be able to develop. He couldn't just pick any subject and see in advance how he could create something miraculous with it. But as I said before, it's not just on an intellectual level. His music is designed just as much to move us emotionally as it does intellectually. And to do that, I think you have to be inspired and you have to have a human element, yeah? And being a genius isn't just about having an intellectual brain. You have to have that human inspiration to back it up, to take it to that next level.
Absolutely. And I think Bach, he must have just reached some sort of very, very happy medium. You know, he must have just been quite contented with his life.
But in this program, I've tried to pick pieces that really do demonstrate why Bach was a genius. And I've picked the A minor violin concerto, and this goes back to him writing music for his students as well, and that deep humility. And the concertos are amazing. Actually, there's more keyboard concertos than anything else, aren't there?
Oh, they're wonderful.
Yeah, I know. And he arranged them for all manner of different.
Well, and another aspect of it in these days before plagiarism, you know, and I guess why not? You know, Bach took the Vivaldi double violin concerto and rearranged it and published it as his own organ concerto.
Ha! Oh, yeah. My Lord.
Yeah. And then a Soviet composer, Samuel Feinberg, has rearranged that back for piano. So it's actually Vivaldi, Bach, Feinberg.
See, there you go.
And shut up for whatever.
It is an amazing thing. And I'd like to play you all the opening of that A minor violin concerto, as it's such an amazing piece. It's got such energy and it's got such drive and it's got a seriousness about it. However, it still dances, doesn't it? Like all of Bach. It's sort of it's the violin version of the wonderful D minor harpsichord concerto, which I just adore. Anyway, here's the opening of the A minor violin concerto. So that was the opening of Bach's Violin Concerto in A minor, BWV 1041, played by the legendary Petra Mullians and the Freiberger Baroque Orchestra. Now, I'm just staggered by the constant inventiveness of Bach, especially in the vocal works, which I only discovered as an adult, actually, because being an instrumentalist, I never got a chance to play or was exposed to any of those cantatas. And weirdly, interestingly, the cantatas form over half of his entire output. And I always encourage instrumentalists to go and listen to them, because I feel you can't know Bach unless you know those cantatas.
Ben, wasn't he writing one a week at one stage of his life?
Yeah, for over 5 years in Leipzig, from 1723 to 1720.
Has humanity progressed since then?
I don't know.
I'm not sure.
But I am just staggered by the sheer inventiveness of the man. And I've picked an aria from his cantata BWV 105, Herr Gehr nichts in Gerichts, which absolutely staggered me the first time I heard it. And I would like to just play this now, just to give a bit of an example of what this man can do with very little. It's a little bit about referring to what you said before, how he does amazing things with such a simple concept. And in this aria, he dispenses entirely with the bass line. He gets rid of it altogether, and he just has violas, violins, one oboe, and one soprano. And look what he can do with it. That was Bach's Cantata BWV 105, Herr, gehe nicht in Gericht mit deinem Knecht. But that was aria number 3, titled Visiten und Wanken, sung by Catherine Fuge and played by the English Baroque soloists, directed by Sir John Eliot Gardiner. Isn't that the most absolutely spine-tingling, goosebump-inducing piece of music? It takes you to a totally different place. That whole cantata actually is very, very special. I really, really adore it. And, you know, there are over 200 of these, and each one of them is so different. It's so special. I mean, the well of imagination never ran dry, did it? Not for one second.
No. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There are some strange early pieces of early Beethoven. Perhaps very, very early Mozart could be deemed to be immature. I mean, there is some very early Chopin that perhaps could be, you know, whatever. Is there any bad Bach? I don't think. Is there any? No.
Nope.
It's all fantastic, isn't it?
Yeah. Unbelievable. Oh, and what a hard life he had too, being orphaned at the age of 9. He had to grow up very fast. And he was shunted off to his older brother, who he barely knew, who was 13 years older, who basically never met the guy. And, yeah, gosh, he really had to get serious about his art and his profession at a very early age, I feel.
Well, see, music became his parents, didn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I was reading, interesting enough, about on a totally different sort of tangent, the great American composer, producer, and ex-trumpet player, Quincy Jones, you know, just a great genius. And his mother was put into a mental asylum when he was aged, I think, 6 or 7, and he just had realized that, okay, I have no more mother. And so somebody wrote in a comment, music became his mother. So.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, music does save us. Music will never abandon you, and music will never let you down.
Exactly. And that's wonderful. Thank you for saying that. I must remember. That's very true.
There's been times.
Not only that, but it uplifts you, doesn't it, when you're down?
Yeah.
It inspires you. It gives you strength, gives you encouragement. It gives you a reason to live, basically. Yes.
Yes. Speaking of reasons for things, I am ending this program with his 6-part Richika from the musical Offering. And I believe this piece of supreme polyphony really does sum up his reason for writing and his reason for being and for getting up in the morning and for continuing to write music. Because obviously, for those of you who know the work, it was written in response to the challenge set by King Frederick the Great of Prussia in 1747 when he went to visit his son, Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach. And he was presented with this incredibly difficult fugue subject, 21 notes in C minor, nasty key, all sorts of chromatic twists and turns and rhythmical difficulties. And the fugue theme was designed to show up Bach, to basically say, well, you're done with now, your way of looking at the world and all this fugue business. It's old, it's dusty, it's tired. We're over it now. We're in the Enlightenment now. Music is for entertainment. It's no longer this serious business. And I'm just going to show you up publicly. But Bach did manage to improvise a 3-part fugue on that subject on the spot. But he couldn't quite manage the 6-part. So what he did was to go away and in the next 2 months compose this work, the musical Offering. He sent it back to King Frederick with a note, a very sort of a flowery note full of supplication going, to your supreme majesty, I present this humble offering in response to your challenge. It was not worthy what I did, but here is something worthy of your greatness. But what he was really saying is, hang on a minute, mate. You know, you think that you're the supreme leader and everything else, but just remember that you serve a much higher power. You and me, we answer to him upstairs. And all my music is designed to reach God. And it goes back to the ancient sort of symbology of a fugue, you know, what it symbolized, what it represents. And the whole idea of reaching upwards to heaven, the harmony of the spheres is tied up in this, you know, it goes back centuries. So what Bach did that by writing this 6-part Richika is to say to him, I can do it. I can take your theme, whatever is presented to me, and I can make something miraculous about it because I serve that higher power. And I think that's what made him great. And this piece of polyphony, it's just staggering. Do you know the work?
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah.
I have that to be, it's there to be discovered.
And now you'll actually hear the work performed by us, actually, Bach Academy Australia, in a performance we gave in 2022 at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music. I decided to put a single string instrument on every part in order for each part to sustain and so you can hear the polyphony better. So I hope you enjoy Bach's 6-part Richika from his musical offering. It's actually physically impossible to play on a harpsichord. You haven't got enough fingers in both hands. Some people can kind of get around it, but not completely. And he never actually specified, I don't think, that it should be played on a harpsichord. And what I like to do in performance is play it on 6 sustaining instruments from one family. And I like to do that with string players because we can sustain and we can develop notes and all of that. Yeah. And it's really interesting because this work looks backwards in time musically. It looks back to the Renaissance, to Palestrina and Gabrielli, the old sort of polyphonic style of writing. And it is it's 7 minutes long, this 6-part fugue. And it has 2 big sections of development. And then it ends with that absolutely amazing sort of pedal point, which comes in all sorts of fugues. And the very last iteration of that subject comes in the bass, the fundamental. It grounds itself. It's an emotional journey all the way through. And I think, I really honestly don't think a single other human being has ever written a piece of more profound, spectacularly moving, technically perfect, but inspirational fugue. I just don't think there's another piece out there that could even come close to this.
Well,
and that is why Bach is a genius. Yes.
Oh, wait.
Yeah. So, Philip, thank you so much for being my guest. It's been amazing to talk to you. Thank you for bringing your insights as a chess champion. Well, you're a champion in my eyes because I can't do it.
Oh, thank you. proud of you and all of your successes. So.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And long live Bach.
Long live Bach. And he eternal.
Eternal.
As long as humanity is alive, Bach is alive.
I agree. That's a very good thing to say. Thank you.
Yes, I think so.
So please come and join us for our next concert series, Bach, the Mind of a Genius, where we will be performing all the works you heard today. We have our first performance on Friday, the 21st of June at Paddington Uniting Church at 7:30 p.m. And then on Sunday, the 23rd of June at Our Lady of Dolores Church in Chatswood at 2:30 p.m. Please do come and hear us then, and click subscribe to this podcast. Every month you'll get a new episode with a new guest exploring all the wonderful aspects of J.S. Bach. Thanks, and see you then.
Bye.